Thank you, everybody. Thank you, thank you. Thank you once again for joining the FIA Group for another one of our webinars. We look forward to talking with you today about some of the hottest topics in our industry, different important questions, concerns, ideas, theories that our consulting team has received from our clients and other members of the industry. We've gone through every question, every concern, everything that's been brought to our attention to identify those topics, those subjects that seem to come up again and again. Also, those ideas and topics that were the most interesting or most innovative, and the things that are most troubling. And we've put it together for today's webinar. Hopefully, we can all learn from others' mistakes and successes and together get something really valuable out of the webinar today. We're going to go ahead and get started first by discussing the social media. You know, it's not just us trying to build up our numbers, although it doesn't hurt to brag a little bit about the enrollment numbers, but this is actually how we obtain the topics that we're going to talk about today. The clients, the followers, the people who are following us on things like LinkedIn often send us questions, concerns, ideas, things that have led to presentations like this, just as much as clients that are submitting questions to our PGC referral hotline. So again, if you are not following us on LinkedIn, but you have ideas that you want to discuss with us, even if it's just brainstorming, don't wait until you have a question or a concern that you think will result in some sort of a memo or research project. No, no, no. Go ahead and follow us on LinkedIn and strike up a conversation. We like that as much as anything else, and this is an opportunity to collaborate and come up with ideas, not only to benefit ourselves, but that may also lead to presentations like this and assist the industry as well. Speaking of opportunities to hear about the things that we're discussing with members of the industry, things that are really stuck in our craw and others, our podcast. This is a recorded podcast. You can download it from various different sources. Of course, we would love if you come visit our own website, the media page, and obtain the podcast from there. But you can also obtain the podcast from various other resources, YouTube, Podomatic, and after popular demand, the Apple Podcast Store as well. So please visit, subscribe, download. Often what you'll find is we'll talk for 5, 10, 15 minutes about a single topic that maybe in a webinar we only spend a couple minutes. So if you're thinking, wow, that's a really important issue that they just briefly talked about during that webinar, I wonder if they're ever going to get into greater detail. For all you know, we already have. Check out the podcast. So I insist, take a look. The first one is on me. All the others are free. All right. So as far as today's speakers are concerned, you have myself, Ron Peck. I am Senior Vice President and General Counsel with the company. With me as well today, a bit of a skeleton crew, we have John Jablon. He is an attorney. He's also the director of our Provider Relations Department. As you might imagine, a number of the hot topics, issues, and concerns people are bringing to our attention relate to interaction between benefit plans and providers of medical services. So this guy is a very busy guy. Another attorney who's extremely busy in the office, you love him, so do I. I don't know about anybody else. But Brady Bizarro, you know, Brady is relatively new to the team, and yet he's definitely hit the ground running. I believe we're recording this webinar, so Brady, this is recorded. You can show this to everyone and pin it on the fridge. Brady has really made himself invaluable as well because of his interest in politics and lawmaking. It was a very opportune time for us and for him to have joined the team. As you might have seen if you've joined us on previous webinars, and certainly if you haven't, let me tell you, Brady has been the guy leading every presentation off, talking about what's going on Capitol Hill, what to expect, how is it going to impact us. And it is a very busy time for him as well. We didn't think this was going to happen, but like I said, the timing was great. So speaking of the political update, Brady, like always, will lead off by talking a little bit about what's going on in politics today. Then we're going to go ahead and jump into those hot topics I was talking about. Again, these are the issues that have impacted the most or the greatest number of clients that have reached out to our consulting team repeatedly, over and over. Different clients, same issue. So chances are that one or all of these issues have impacted you as well. If none of these issues have impacted you, either A, you're ignorant, B, you're lying, or C, you're lucky. I hope it's C. If we do not discuss some of the most pressing matters that are impacting you, by all means, please submit those questions. Follow us on LinkedIn and leave a comment. Contact us directly. The contact information that was provided, PGC referral at theagroup.com as well. Let us know what's going on in your life, and maybe you'll make it to the next webinar as well. But without further ado, let's go ahead and get started with this webinar and the political update from our own Brady Bizarro. Brady?
Thanks, Ron. So this is one of those times, guys, where we have updates that are happening literally hours before the webinar. So these slides are still good slides, but just about an hour and a half ago, the Senate posted online their revision to their own version of a health care reform bill, which is known affectionately as the Better Care Reform Act or Reconciliation Act, is the text of the bill. So if you've been following politics recently in the last few weeks, which I'm sure most people have been, you would notice that the Senate's having trouble passing their health care bill. Now, why, you might ask, is that the case? Well, because they got a CBO score from the Congressional Budget Office, which estimated that about 22 million people would lose insurance coverage by 2020. Now, a number of other problems with this bill are really stalling it in the Senate, one of which is that it appears like the goal of this bill is to cut taxes on the wealthy and trim benefits for people on Medicaid, and that's been an unpopular characterization that the Senate has been trying to get out from underneath. Other problems within the conference itself. You have the moderates who are concerned about deep cuts to care. You have the conservatives who want to see less government involvement in care. And so the Senate Majority Leader here is really playing this sort of difficult game where he's trying to appease two wings of the Republican Party, and he only can afford to lose two senators. He has to get 50 votes, and the pressure is on. The president's been tweeting about how he wants to get this done. They're desperate to move on to other issues. This repeal and replace bill is sort of the seminal issue that Republicans have been talking about for 7 years. And so really, this is the moment where we're going to find out if they can actually repeal the ACA or not. I don't think if they fail to do something about it now, it's hard to see how they're going to have time to really pass a repeal and replace bill in the future. And time is short. So Tuesday, the Senate Majority Leader announced that he's going to delay vacation for lawmakers, which, you know, for a lot of us, we kind of scoff at and think is funny, but it's a big deal for them. They typically get 4 weeks off in August. Now they're going to have 2 weeks off, and that has been done sort of as a preemptive measure. In case they can't get this bill where it needs to be, he's leaving himself some breathing room, both in time and in numbers. He left himself $200 billion to play with to try to sort of buy off support of those outstanding holdout Republican senators who have concerns about coverage in their own states. So in a word or in a couple words, I would say that this bill is on life support as of now. Now, there was a scramble to revise the bill, and one of the interesting parts that was added, and it did actually make it into the final text of the bill, is something called the Ted Cruz Amendment, which he's called the Consumer Freedom Option. This was sort of an interesting idea from Senator Cruz that was designed to really get more conservatives on board. And essentially what his revision does is it allows health insurers to offer, as long as they offer at least one plan that does meet the ACA requirements in terms of essential health benefits and meeting the coverage requirements of preventative care, they're then able to offer a bare bones plan for a much cheaper price. And so that is where you get the phrase, you know, consumer choice from. But it's essentially a way to try to get the few conservative holdouts on board. Now, there are other ideas that are floating around as well in terms of improving the bill. Flexibility with HSAs, which I'll talk about in a second. More money for opioid treatment. This is an important thing for Republican governors. There's a big having more money for stability funds for people who have chronic conditions who would be covered. So basically more money is some of the ideas that are being tacked onto the bill. The two sticking points, though, are pre-existing conditions and Medicaid cuts. So keep that in mind as you see revisions of the bill come out, and you'll see that those are the two things that we're really struggling with or the conference is struggling with in terms of how to get a bill that can pass with 50 votes. So what's the timeline we expect? Well, just today, the draft bill was released, and I'll talk about it in brief in a second. Early next week, we expect two new Congressional Budget Office scores. One of them will be a score of the draft bill that includes Senator Cruz's amendment, and one will be a version without his amendment. And the goal is to see which one is sort of worse and then to sort of put that one away and ignore it. But mid-next week, we expect a vote on the motion to proceed. This is sort of a procedural thing in the Senate. essentially where before a bill can even make it to the floor, you need to get the senators to agree that there will be a motion to proceed. And so if it can't even pass that stage, you won't even see a floor vote. If it does pass that stage, then we expect the next few weeks you will see a floor vote. The idea is was to have that vote before the August recess. Now that's been pushed out a few weeks, there's some more time for that. So what are the options for the majority leader here in terms of getting this bill passed or not? He can delay the vote if he thinks he doesn't have the votes. He can hold the vote and members will vote against the motion to proceed and the bill will die. He can hold the vote and members will vote for the motion to proceed and the bill may still fail. Or the best case scenario for the Senate, or Republican Senate rather, and the President, is that the members vote on the motion to proceed and they pass this bill, which then would turn into a reconciliation act between the House and the Senate, and eventually a bill on the President's desk, which as we noticed, he desperately wants. Now there is another thing worth noting, which is that Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and another senator have come up with sort of a secret alternative proposal that's not so much of a secret anymore, but he's trying to woo Democrats in basically a backup plan. In case they can't get this bill passed, is there a way to reach out across the aisle and get something done? But it's hard to see that really going anywhere, given the political climate in Washington right now. So before I get to this slide, I'll just talk briefly about what was released just an hour and a half ago, the updated version of the Better Care Reconciliation Act. So as I mentioned, it includes most prominently Ted Cruz's Consumer Freedom Amendment. So again, this is the idea that you're going to allow consumers more choice by permitting insurers to offer cheaper bare-bone plans that do not meet the ACA coverage requirements. So as long as they offer one plan that does, in the exchanges, outside the exchanges, they can offer a plan that does not cover essential health benefits, that does not cover preventive care, that does not cover mental health and substance abuse treatment. So the idea there is that it would obviously cost a lot less for these plans. The problem with that is that you're lumping together potentially sick people into one risk pool, and you're allowing the younger, healthier people to purchase cheaper, less expensive plans. And so the problem of adverse selection is a big deal for this. Now, to try and placate that problem, what the Senate has done in this new revision is they provided a federal fund, basically a slush fund, as it's known in Washington, to help pay health insurers to cover the cost of these sick people who would, in theory, be grouping together into risk pools, which could be a bad thing. So we'll see how this amendment, you know, more discussions being, you know, had about this as we speak, but that's the amendment that's been added in. It's the biggest change to the bill. Aside from that, there are other important changes that are made, one of which is a change to the HSA rule. So the first time the Senate plans to allow people to use their HSAs to pay their premiums, which was not previously allowed under the IRS. If you recall, paying for insurance premiums was not considered a qualified medical expense, except in narrow cases like paying for COBRA. That would be a big change if that makes it through the final bill. More generous subsidies. So the old bill, you'd receive subsidies if you made 350% of the poverty level. That's been raised to 400%. So you're getting, you know, more subsidies. That's a better thing for the conservatives who are more concerned about people with less money being able to afford care. Also, more options to buy lower premium plans. This revision would allow people to buy high deductible catastrophic plans with federal tax credits. So under the ACA, you were not allowed to use your subsidies to buy so-called catastrophic plans. Again, the thinking there was that you didn't want young, healthy people to be buying just catastrophic plans because you'd be creating risk pools that had segregation. You had sick people in one pool, healthy people in the other. This would be a big change where you'd allow people to buy catastrophic plans. As I mentioned before, there's more money in this bill to help treat the opioid epidemic. They're increasing provider reimbursements for Medicaid patients. That's sort of a nudge to the provider community, which has been largely against this bill so far. And finally, just more money in general. There's $70 billion being added to stabilize the insurance exchanges over the next decade. That comes on top of already $112 billion that was in the original bill. So where did we find this $200 billion suddenly? Well, the last important part of this revision is that it discards the earlier plans in the Senate bill to cut taxes on, well, there were three taxes under the ACA that were on the wealthier Americans, including one tax on investment income for hospital executives. So by keeping those in place, by not cutting those taxes, the Senate Majority Leader has freed up $200 billion that he can now shift around, and that's what he's done in this update. The time is short, as I mentioned, and in case it does not pass, there is a plan B apparently here, which would be to repeal the bill for now and replace at a later date. So the President has tweeted things like, we could let Obamacare crash and burn on its own. We'll see what happens. But the bottom line is the markets are in free fall. And I'm not sure the Republicans are going to be willing to work across the aisle if necessary to get this to get the ACA fixed. We'll know what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. And as always, we'll be watching closely. And so with that, I will turn it over.
Thank you, Brady. And what I took from that is that the legislature gets 4 weeks off in August normally, which sounds fantastic.
That's all I got to.
We'll talk about that with Adam as soon as he comes back. But I'm going to jump into the meat of today's webinar. And one topic here is incorporating vendor programs. It doesn't matter who you are listening to this webinar, whether you are a member of a vendor organization or if you're a TPA or a broker or any type of consultant or health plan or really anyone, you've dealt in some capacity with some sort of vendor program. As we all know, one of the great things about this self-funded universe is the add-ons. You can get away from the cookie-cutter approach of traditional fully funded insurance, but there's more to self-funding than just cost containment structuring your own plan document. There are dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of little add-ons here and there that you can use that are offered by vendors, whether it's individual service carve-outs, telemedicine, medical travel. I mean, you name it, it's available. There are vendors just all over the industry ready and willing to offer you things that will be beneficial to your employee populations. One of the things that we do here at the FIA Group, and one of the things with which our consulting division has been incredibly busy, is questions from vendors, from TPAs, from brokers, basically from all of you, about how to incorporate these vendor programs, what they mean, what they're offering, how the contracts work, how to implement them, how to sell them, etc. Tons and tons of questions. And what we like to do is kind of lump them into four basic categories that are really mostly conceptual. I mean, we don't really structure our business across these four lines, but we've separated them here like this just for a better way to explain all the different things that need to be looked at. So for one thing is concept vetting. Looking at the initial concept. So if you are a TPA or broker and a vendor comes to you and says, we've got this awesome program, you should look into it. It's tough to know where to start, whether it's viable, whether it's compliant, how to use it, or how to use it, rather, and best practices for that program. Asking that vendor those questions is always a good start. There's always marketing materials and other things that can be provided, but looking at it from a more practical, maybe more objective standard is also always recommended. And another thing is a creation of the program. Primarily has to do with contracts and plan language, and of course the plan document is a contract, possibly the most important one for an arrangement like this. So making sure that you have proper plan language is extremely important. And again, the different programs may have plan language associated with them, but a lot of programs also rely on the plan sponsor to kind of create the language as it sees fit. Certainly not necessarily a bad thing, just because it gives the plan sponsor more freedom to incorporate the program as it chooses, but it's also the case that many plans are a bit unsure of what type of language needs to be added in particular situations. And then we're on the topic of sales. And if you are a TPA, or broker, you are likely not concerned with how to sell these programs because they have come to you. But if you are a vendor, or even if you are with a TPA or broker working with a vendor to try to disseminate a program, the basic questions are, who will this benefit? Who needs it? How do we market it? And where's the real value? You know, there are a lot of programs out there, and the value can really be questionable until you dig into the weeds and you look at your claims data and you realize, wow, this really would make a big difference for us. You know, having access to claims data is, of course, another huge, huge benefit of self-funding and yet another reason that fully insured policies do not really get the benefit of programs like this, both because you cannot examine the data to see whether you need it a lot of the time and because you can't add stuff like this because a lot of the times even self-funding with an ASO carrier, one of the BUCAs, you just can't amend the plan as you would need to do. So knowing the value and kind of who needs it, that can be the key to whether or not a program like this is effective and makes any sense to evaluate. And then lastly here is implementation. How do you onboard groups for this? And, you know, once you've sold it to a group, what then? How do you get a group involved in a program? How do you get the program how do you educate the members is a really good question, you know, and that's one that we do face a lot in our consulting division. And then, of course, as a last note, when you're looking at a vendor program, it of course needs to mesh with all the other various vendor programs that you may be using. Self-funded plans, for instance, and this is just one kind of very basic example that we deal with all the time, self-funded plans very, very commonly use PPO networks. But there are other vendors that purport to help you save money on certain types of claims, specific types, and we call those carve-outs, whether it's dialysis or cancer or hemophilia or what. But the bottom line is when you're using a vendor like that, if you have a PPO contract and the claim is with an in-network provider, you're going to need to look at the contract and make sure that you can use that vendor's services and it won't violate your existing contracts. Again, just one example of the PPO versus carve-out, but it's a very, very popular one, one that we see all the time, and I think actually one that we will talk about a little bit more later in this presentation. So a couple of examples about incorporating vendor programs, and these examples kind of bring up some of the questions that we are asked, and I hope to give you some food for thought regarding these. So the first example here is telemedicine. And essentially, a TPA contacted us and our consulting division over at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com regarding a telemedicine program that a vendor had proposed to that TPA. And their primary questions were regarding the plan language. They had gone through the contracts, gone through the marketing, they were very happy, and then they turned around and said, okay, you know, we want to buy this program, we want to push it to our groups, but we don't really know what to do in terms of plan language. We need to know how to get it implemented. So some of the questions included, should we put it within the existing plan document? Or should we maybe make some standalone document that's separate from the plan document that's governed by ERISA? And how would a program like this affect a high deductible health plan? Always a good question to ask with vendor programs. How can member incentives be structured? So in other words, if we want our members to have some financial incentive to use this program because it will be so beneficial to us and to them, how should we do that? And then, of course, can this be offered to all employees or just those enrolled in the plan? That is a question with which we tend to have a singular strong opinion at Fear Group Consulting, and spoiler alert, we always recommend if it's a plan benefit, limit it to the plan. If you offer something to all employees that's in the plan document and essentially reserved for plan members, you're going to have a bit of an issue, and that's actually something that Ron will talk about when we talk about documents kind of contradicting each other and various documents that can create so-called gaps. So taking a step back, you know, and I will I'm not going to leave you with these answers kind of open-ended, but I will go very, very briefly on each bullet. Essentially, if you have a telemedicine program that applies to plan members, yes, it should be stated within the plan document. If you have a benefit for the plan that's not in the plan document, you're almost always going to have trouble. We always recommend that if it applies to the plan, it goes in the plan. And the issue of a separate standalone policy or maybe another very limited scope plan document, that can get a bit complex when you're dealing with things like the mandates from the ACA. Any kind of standalone policy that's governed by ERISA is going to have to conform to those mandates as well. So if you're looking to have kind of a one-page, completely separate thing, be very careful there because it's not quite so simple. Another question, as I mentioned, was how would a program like this affect a high-deductible health plan? Well, a high-deductible health plan cannot pay plan benefits until the deductible is satisfied. That much is within the regs. If you want it to stay HSA-qualified, it cannot pay first dollar. So aside from that, we are not aware of anything that would tend to disallow a high-deductible health plan to use any particular vendor program. But just keep in mind that if this particular program contains a structure of benefits that necessarily involves paying first dollar, you might need to amend it slightly for a high deductible health plan. And we, at this point, we would urge you to check with the vendors because most vendors have considered this and probably have some sort of backup plan or slight program modification just specifically for a high deductible health plan. So. And the other example here of a vendor program is a very, extremely popular one, dialysis. There are lots of vendors floating out there in the industry who can provide a lot of cost-saving options for dialysis claims. And if you've listened to our past webinars or if you have experienced dialysis claims, it should be no secret to you that they are among the most egregious out there in the industry today. So we had a broker come to our consulting department and ask regarding a vendor's services. And this was a specific vendor. The questions were more about compliance than anything else. And if you've dealt with dialysis carve-outs, you may be aware that there are certain compliance concerns created by CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, just because they are subject to slightly different rules and regulations than ordinary claims. So the questions, are Medicare rates enforceable payment? How does a program like this work within a PPO network? And that's something that I just mentioned a minute ago. Can members be balance billed? And can the plan lower benefits for people with ESRD, that's end-stage renal disease, unless they enroll in Medicare? So backing up a bit, first question, are Medicare rates enforceable payment? Very good question. Thank you for asking. It is one with which we deal very frequently, and it is actually extremely relevant not only to this type of program, but to really all Medicare-based, reference-based pricing. The question of whether or not Medicare rates are enforceable really stems from the first question, does the plan document say that Medicare rates are acceptable? And second, is the percentage of Medicare chosen objectively reasonable by the plan administrator standards, and will that hold up if challenged in a court of law? The question to whether or not a court of law would agree is always unpredictable because we can never guarantee anything that a given court would say. We've seen decisions come out and we can't believe what we're reading. We've seen decisions come out and we say, oh, of course. But at the end of the day, there is precedent to suggest that Medicare rates are enforceable if done right, if there's no conflicting contract, if the language of the plan document is clear, if all the ducks are in a row, there's really no reason that some sort of derivation of Medicare rates would not be enforceable. So regarding a PPO network, I just mentioned this. If the PPO network has a contract with language that contradicts what you're trying to do, it's going to be trouble. So our recommendation is always check those contracts. Check those contracts. I cannot stress that enough. If your contract doesn't work with the program you want, then the program is destined to fail. So check those contracts. Question of can members be balance billed largely depends on whether the member is enrolled in Medicare, usually Part B. And this is a question that the particular vendor might be better suited to answer, so we definitely urge you to talk to the vendor about the legal protections of members who are enrolled in Medicare versus those of members who are not enrolled in Medicare. And lastly, this is a question that actually comes up quite frequently. Can the plan lower benefits for people with ESRD, again, that's end-stage renal disease, unless they enroll in Medicare? So essentially, can you punish people for not enrolling in Medicare? Short answer, no, you cannot. Like I said, the question comes up very frequently. There are lots of derivatives of this language, lots of loopholes that historically plan drafters have tried to jump through, but at the end of the day, CMS does not allow you to discriminate based on ESRD, and it does not allow you to discriminate based on whether or not Medicare has been elected by the member.
Thanks, John. Well, I want to answer one question we got here, which is sort of in regard to the political update that I gave before. Somebody asked here about the changes that are being proposed to HSA rules, and if there's a change or this bill fails, what will happen to those proposals? Well, the answer is that so far, at least, this idea is attached as an amendment to the Senate health care bill. So if the Senate health care bill does go down the drain, which may in fact actually happen, then we would need separate legislation to allow for, or some kind of other agency guidance or interpretation that would allow for premiums to be reimbursed using an HSA. So I just wanted to clarify that before I turn it back over to Ron.
And actually, I'm sorry, this is John again. Before we turn it back over to Ron, we are just getting flooded with questions, and one of the ones that I want to make sure I touch on, this was asked by a gentleman who I know his organization is dealing with an issue that concerns us right now, so I know that this question is particularly relevant to him. The question is, why does it seem that the PPO contracts trump other contracts, and those other contracts are likely the plan document? Well, the reason it seems that they do is not actually because they do, but because the PPO contract and the plan document are two completely separate agreements signed by separate people with separate obligations and governed by different bodies of law. So, for instance, The plan document is the plan sponsor, the employer, promising to that the plan will pay the provider a given payment. If that payment is X, then the plan will pay X. It's very, very simple as far as plan language goes. But the PPO contract is signed by the employer in its capacity as just a company, not in its capacity as a health plan administrator, but the company itself. So the FIA Group LLC has separately in the PPO contract promised to pay the provider a different amount than the plan has promised to pay. So the problem is neither one trumps the other one. It's just that they are separate. So the provider can go after the plan for what the plan owes, but the provider can go after the employer for what the employer owes. When those amounts are different, of course, only one amount can be paid. You have to choose one. And if medical providers are not paid their contracted rate, it doesn't really matter what the plan language says. If you've signed a contract to pay more, that contract is going to be enforced separately from the plan, not instead of the plan, but separately from the plan.
Thanks, guys. So good stuff so far, and a really good lead in to this next slide, which I don't know if I love or hate the way you phrase this one, John. Common GAAP document pairs, but it's growing.
You totally didn't like it.
It's growing on me, actually. I kind of like it. So what we're talking about right now and what John just talked about in response to some of the questions, I think really cuts to the core, cuts to the bone of what it is to be a self-funded benefit plan under ERISA and federal law and preemption versus all of these side deals and side contracts that seem to get in our way when it comes to being a prudent, cost-effective fiduciary of the plan. And this has been something, and I mean, this may actually predate, I know it predates Brady, and it may predate John, believe it or not. It's certainly been the better part of a decade. I remember when we came up with the phrase ERISA man, and he was that superhero, where if you have a self-funded benefit plan, you know, and you agree to a contract, you agree to some sort of arrangement, and it's independent and separate from the plan, and eventually somebody tries to call you out and enforce that deal, enforce that contract, and it doesn't jive with the plan document, there's this attitude in the industry that you can come out and say, well, you know, that contract doesn't apply anymore. We can ignore it because the plan document controls all. It's ERISA man, right? Here comes ERISA man to save the day. And unfortunately, a number of our own clients and other members of the industry have discovered over time that that's not the case. And there have been situations where a provider is looking to enforce the terms of a contract against the plan. The defense comes out, ERISA man, that contract, it would require us to breach the plan document, and we have a fiduciary duty to enforce the plan as written. The plan controls all, ERISA, preemption, federal law, we win. And that provider or that network or whomever it is that's suing the plan, they say, you know what, you're right. The plan only has to pay what the plan document says. We're just going to go after the TPA instead. We're going to go after the broker. We're going to go after the employer. And we're going to enforce the contract against them. And the courts side with them. So ultimately, the takeaway message is this. And realistically, if you look at this from a common sense, objective perspective, and I'm afraid I'm going to upset some people who are on the line right now. If I have a document that controls what I can and cannot do, shame on me if I subsequently sign a contract that conflicts with that document. Shame on me for telling somebody that I can or can't do something that my plan document, my controlling document, prohibits. If you're going to argue later on that you can or can't obey a contract because the plan document doesn't allow it, then you shouldn't have entered into that contract in the first place. That's the argument they're going to make in front of a court, and that's what's going to burn you. And that's why John said it's so important to look at the contract. Now, we're talking about you already have a plan, you already have a contract. Now we're asking what can we do to contain cost in light of that contract. I truly wish we could go back in time before that contract was even signed and review that contract and ask, down the line,
if I want to interpret the plan a certain way, will this contract prohibit it? Down the line, if I need to contain costs or carve out a service that's going to be high cost, will this contract prohibit it? And if so, if this contract is going to stop me from being a prudent fiduciary of the plan, I won't sign it in the first place. But unfortunately, we deal with the cards that were dealt. And speaking of contracts that are in place, deals that are in place that may potentially conflict with the plan or with each other, you see before you a list of gap document pairs. The classic, and in my opinion, still one of the most fun, is the plan document versus stop loss. We talk about it all the time, hard gaps and soft gaps. Hard gap is, with a little effort, you look at the two documents side by side, and you see that there's a conflict there. The classic that we always give out is the criminal act versus felony, where somebody driving under the influence of alcohol, that's a misdemeanor. It's a criminal act. If stop loss excludes all claims arising from criminal acts and somebody's hurt in a drug driving accident, stop loss is going to deny those claims. But if the plan document says that you exclude claims only coming from felonies, well, that's not a felony. And so the plan is required to pay. And so you find a hard gap. A soft gap is where the language mirrors each other. It says the same thing. But how the different parties, the plan versus stop loss, interpret the same language differs. Those are much harder to predict and require much more communication between the parties. Another example, of course, being the ASO versus the SPD. This, again, is where the service agreement says that somebody is going to do or not do something. Meanwhile, the plan document says something different. Maybe the ASO agreement says, you know, this entity is going to be the one who makes the initial claims payment decisions, but the plan document says that the plan sponsor makes the decisions. Again, make sure that those jive. The PPO contract, you know, between the PPO contract and stop loss or the PPO contract and the plan document, in my mind, those are basically the same thing. More and more you're going to find now that stop loss is mirroring the plan document, that stop loss is adopting the plan document as part of the stop loss policy itself. So what stop loss is saying when they see you paying a network rate and then reimburse you much less than that, they're not saying that the PPO contract conflicts with the stop loss. They're saying that the PPO contract conflicts with the plan document. They're saying that they, as a carrier, interpret the plan document as requiring you to apply some sort of usual, customary, reasonable, appropriate, and even a reference-based or Medicare-based pricing mechanism, and that they're going to reimburse you with stop loss as if you had paid based on their interpretation of your plan document. Another one I want to make sure I touch on before we move on is the handbook. You see we're talking about the handbook and the SPD, the handbook and the stop loss. It's amazing what's coming out of the woodwork now that this issue has been brought to the light. The number of employers out there, I don't know who these employers are, but we got to find them, guys. We got to get out of here and we got to go work for these people because they are so generous and so kind to their employees. Thank you. Generous employers, you're wonderful people. You're putting in your handbook that you're going to extend medical benefit plan coverage to people who are on an authorized leave of absence or a legal leave of absence for as long as the leave exists. You could be on an authorized leave of absence for 3 years and not show up to work, and we're going to keep you on the health plan because that's the kind of people we are. That's so beautiful. It warms my heart. The problem is when your plan document says that if someone doesn't come to work for 30 days, they get kicked from the plan, that's all stop loss is seeing, and that's all stop loss is going to cover. So if somebody's on a leave of absence, the handbook has them covered by the plan indefinitely, they go and they suffer a catastrophic get loss, the claim goes to stop loss, they're going to say, why is this guy on the plan? Plan document says they should have been kicked years ago. That's a gap, and that's something that we don't want to see. So there we're talking about the leave of absence. I want to dig in a little bit more deeply with this very quickly. What I just gave to you is an example, we'll call it again a hard gap, where you have a handbook that says one thing, if you're on a leave of absence, we'll keep you on the benefit plan, and then you have a plan document that says something different. If you're not at work for 30 days or less, you get removed from the plan. Those two documents, hard gap, can't coexist. If you read the two side by side, you're going to spot the issue. But some of the other leave of absence issues that we've dealt with, and recently we had a case where we were dealing with an attorney who didn't understand this, is that sometimes the law requires you to offer a leave of absence. This has nothing to do with a handbook. And there's an attitude out there amongst some attorneys that if somebody is on a legally required leave of absence, that they therefore have a right to benefit coverage under the health plan as well. And what they don't understand is that the right to a leave of absence is not the right to health benefits coverage, and understanding the difference between the two. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to John, see if he has any other comments about what we've been seeing from the handbook leave of absence conflict gap with the plan document before we move on to the next topic.
So thanks, Ron. There actually is one slide here that we just skipped because Ron actually already brought up almost the exact example on that slide. And I was trying to motion to Brady, but it's hard to communicate in silence. But
right.
The example Ron brought up is a very, very common one, where it creates a stop-loss gap more than anything else. Practically speaking, is anyone going to complain that more benefits were paid than what the plan document allows? Probably not. You know, obviously we never recommend breaching the fiduciary duty and paying benefits outside the terms of the plan document, but at the end of the day, what member is complaining that you paid his claims? Nobody. The problem, of course, is stop-loss, because stop-loss, or maybe not nobody, maybe stop-loss is complaining that you pay that member's claims. But at the end of the day, you know, when you're looking at stop-loss is kind of sitting there on the back end of everything that's happening. It has to sit there and witness all these things happening, but it doesn't really have a firsthand view. So what it sees is really a summary of everything that happened. So when stop-loss gets a claim, it reads through the timeline and it stars certain things and it says, why did you do this? Why did you do this? You probably should not have done this. And the answer is, well, we wanted to be, like Ron said, we wanted to be a generous employer. We really value our employee base. It's a small family-based company, et cetera. But from the stop-loss carrier's perspective, they have underwritten a plan document with very specific provisions. And if those provisions are violated, we cannot reasonably expect stop-loss to just kind of bend to the whims of the employer when the carrier hasn't been notified of any of this beforehand.
You know, that's a really good point. And one of the things that I think I'm starting to notice in general is this pattern where stop loss is almost like a litmus test or a crystal ball where they can predict how things are going to trickle down to other entities in the near future. You know, stop loss, because they're the back end, because they're the one who holds the bag on the large claims, they're the first ones to react to, for instance, specialty drugs, right? The rising cost of specialty drugs or the med flight. Right, the air ambulance, you know, they realize, oh, yeah, these claims are escalating way too quickly. They're the first ones to react. And what ends up happening, either it's because stop loss is refusing to reimburse or they're increasing their premium, or maybe they were just the first to notice, but other people start to get concerned, it starts to trickle back upstream. Those costs, those issues, those conflicts end up impacting the TPA and their relationship with the plan. The plan is being asked to pay more. Maybe they're complaining to their broker, to their advisor. And slowly but surely, it works its way right back to the employees. And years later, the thing that was bothering stop loss is now a thing that the entire industry is talking about as an issue. So the examples being, I already gave you some of the high-cost medical expenses that are out there. I truly believe now that these gaps, these excess coverage, the coverage of people who shouldn't be enrolled, you know, this new leave of absence handbook conflict with the plan, this is starting to come to light. I suspect that eventually this is going to be less of a stop-loss issue and become more of an industry issue. And one thing that's actually interesting, John, you mentioned that, you know, the person, the individual whose claims are being paid is not going to complain. But I do wonder if at some point when the cost of the plan starts to increase, if enough people start to ask, hey, why are our rates going up? Well, because we're paying for John's disease. You know, he's been costing our plan for years and years and years. Well, John doesn't work here anymore. Yeah, no. He's on an extended leave of absence, so he's still covered by the plan. Well, you know, I read the plan document. It doesn't say anything about that. At what point do we start to worry that maybe the plan participants themselves are going to realize that their plan funds, the money they're contributing, is being misused, misallocated towards expenses that aren't actually covered by the plan document? And are they going to point the finger at the employer and accuse them of fiduciary breach? So, you know, again, it's easy to point the finger at stop loss and say, ah, it's tough love, those sticklers. But at the same time, if they're trying to apply a very hard line application of the plan terms, at what point could we potentially see the plan members themselves enforcing those same terms and accusing us of fiduciary breach? And in that case, is the time now to identify those potential areas where we're not doing what the plan document says we're supposed to do and change our ways to avoid those conflicts in the first place? And I think that, you know, really applies here when you talk about what's the employer's role, TPA role. You know, it's important to understand your responsibility as a fiduciary to apply the plan terms as written. And if you want to change things, if you want to incentivize behavior, if you want to be more generous, that's fine. But it needs to be across the board, written, understood, and uniform. If I want my employees to go to an emergency clinic, right, a walk-in clinic instead of the emergency room, you know, I need to actually adjust the copays and deductibles in the plan document. I also need to put something in the handbook that notifies them that I did that. I need to educate people. As an employer, I need to let my employees know that I've done that. So this way, everybody's on the same page. They understand the plan terms. Everything is uniform, and you're applying those plan terms as written. Brady?
Thanks, Ron. So before I talk about the enormous issue about exclusions and the issue of causation, I want to mention one more thing on this leave of absence issue we just discussed. So Ron did a good job before of making the distinction between leave of absence and continuation of coverage. However, one sort of new issue we've been seeing lately involves state laws. And so most recently, New York just passed a paid family leave law, which is one of the most generous in the country and takes effect next year. And the unique part about this law is that it actually mandates employers continue coverage for the duration of that leave. I believe it's 8 weeks of paid leave, and for the duration of that leave, you must extend coverage. Now, how does that impact a self-funded plan? Turns out this is a very long, complicated answer that we don't have time to talk about in this webinar per se, but just know that this raises issues about ERISA preemption and whether self-funded employers have to follow along with what state laws mandate with regard to continuation of coverage. One last point on this issue is someone asked a question here about the Americans with Disabilities Act and whether or not they must extend coverage if an employer grants a leave as a reasonable accommodation. So there is no explicit requirement in the ADA like there is, say, on the Federal Family Medical Leave Act law that requires continuation of coverage. However, we recommend a conservative approach is to extend coverage when you grant an employee an ADA leave as a reasonable accommodation. So I wanted to answer those 2 points. Now, on to the issue of exclusions. This is another big topic that we've been bombarded with questions lately. In particular, we're looking at really 2 issues here. One is the source of injury rule, and the other is the issue of causation. I'll take the first one, the source of injury rule first. So as we know, under the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 29, you are not allowed to apply an exclusion to exclude claims if those claims were caused by a medical condition or if the injury was caused by the patient being a victim of domestic violence. So even if, you know, you try to exclude things like self-inflicted injuries, if it can be shown that that injury was caused by a medical condition, then you're not allowed to apply that exclusion. And so one of the keys to know on that point is that while you do have to, or while the member has to prove the diagnosis and it has to be documented, it need not have been documented prior to the injury occurring. So you could have a case where someone, you know, has this issue under the health plan, they're facing an exclusion of claims after their DWI or something, and then they go see a doctor, and the doctor says, hey, you have depression, and they document that. After the fact, courts have held that that's sufficient to trigger that prohibition on denying claims as a result of medical conditions. So in short, you got to be careful when you use these exclusions, and we recommend that you have a catch-all here, meaning rather than under each exclusion in the plan say, you know, this exclusion shall not apply in the result in the case of domestic violence or medical condition, if you just put a statement at the top of your section, of your exclusion section, saying that, you know, none of these exclusions will apply if the accident or injury is as the result of domestic violence or medical condition, it's much easier that way, it's more simple that way, and you're really going to help avoid confusion on that point. So the issue of causation, also a big one, but I want to touch on it briefly here because we have seen a number of questions on this issue. So the summary here is that most plans do not have in their actual text a causal disclaimer, meaning they say things like, if an injury is caused while committing an illegal act, or if the injury was the result of an illegal act, then they exclude the claims. Well, that obviously raises the question, what if the actual injuries were not caused by the illegal act? Or what if the act did not contribute in any way? So in legalese, it's sort of making a distinction between a temporal link or a time frame versus an actual causal link. And this is important for tort law, but for our purposes, just know that we have updated our template in the past, I believe, year or so, to include language that says that this exclusion, whatever it may be, will apply even if the injuries were not caused by the illegal act in question. And that's been done as a response to, you know, questions we've seen in appeals where we see attorneys raising the issue of causation, saying that, hey, there is no relationship between the two. So as an example, we can talk about how a member would be stopped at a red light. He is clearly drunk. His car is not moving. And then he gets broadsided by a truck. So was that the truck was at fault, is the implication here, the driver of the truck's at fault. Was that injury caused by him being under the influence of alcohol, or was that injury caused by, you know, a third party? In other words, there's no direct causation between him drinking and being, you know, stopped at a red light and being broadsided by this truck. And so if the language, you know, at first glance, it may seem like it supports a denial, but if it does not contain an explicit disclaimer of the causation requirement, we have seen court cases where the court will read a causation requirement into the language. And one example of that is in South Carolina, which has a special law which says that for cases where plans exclude drunk driving or intoxication, there must be a causal link between the two things. So in that case, obviously having a causal disclaimer in your self-funded plan is going to be very, very important. If you don't have that language, you're going to have trouble really excluding the claim, or you'll be forced to, say, sort through injuries of what was caused by and what was not caused by the injury. And so that's a big issue that we see more and more.
And as a final very quick note on that, we are not aware of any court that has said that language like that is not enforceable. The language will be enforceable, except the courts will often imply a causation requirement into that language just to make it more equitable for the member. So the language is not illegal. You don't need to get rid of it. But if you don't have a causal requirement, one may be implied.
So as we jump into the exciting world of DOL audits to finish it off, because who doesn't want to leave on a high note, I quickly want to address a couple of comments that we have here in the question box. One individual asked the question, you know, I understand that we should not be executing a contract on the one hand that completely conflicts with the plan document on the other, but often what happens is we're not allowed to see, or we don't get to sign the contract that actually conflicts with the plan document. We're signing some in-between document that doesn't actually conflict with the plan. And I understand exactly what you're talking about. You know, a lot of the PPO contracting structure works where a plan document on the one hand, and then you sign a payer agreement on the other, and it basically says, we understand you have a plan document, everything you agree to pay is within the terms of the plan document is great, and it controls. Fantastic. Except there's one line hidden in the contract that says, oh, by the way, we have a contract between us, the network, and the provider, and anywhere there's a conflict between this contract and that one, that provider contract prevails. It reigns supreme. It overrides this agreement. If you see that line, and it's usually hidden and worded in a very ambiguous manner, that's the warning sign. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I understand it's not realistic to just dump it all and say, forget it, we're not going to use a network, we're just going to go completely out there and apply reference-based pricing. If people get balance bills, so be it, ha, ha, ha. That's not for everybody. I understand that. It's not a market reality. And so the reason why we bring this up here today is less in order to encourage you to just eliminate your networks and more just for you to look at the network, understand what you've agreed to, and understand why you need to tread carefully when applying a new vendor service. The other question related to the ADA reasonable accommodation, again, like Brady said, we're not saying that you can't extend health benefit coverage to people who are on leaves of absence or that have excused time away from work, either based on law or a handbook. What we are saying is make sure your plan document, your communication with stop loss reflects this rather than conflict or contradict it, because that's what's going to end up getting you in trouble when and if a claim goes to stop loss. It's okay to extend coverage, but if stop loss doesn't know that you're extending coverage, that's where the issue comes up. So the DOL, what are they worried about? What are they looking at? It is a hot time for the DOL.
They are looking at the way benefit plans are administering claims. They are looking at many different areas where plans may be falling short. However, these are the areas that we've seen most recently come up more than once. The way people are treating the pre-existing condition issue, mental health parity, understanding it's more than just how you pay, but what you pay for, the quality of coverage, treating it the same way as the medical benefits. A lot of people are talking about, well, how do we put a limit on mental health? You know, we're not allowed to limit it financially. Could we limit the number of visits? So, again, anytime you're looking at doing something unique to mental health care, you need to, again, make sure that it's reflected the same way by medical and that someone's not going to claim that there's any kind of discrimination there. Also, funds being held in trust. This has really been more of an issue when the plan doesn't have adequate assets to cover the claims. The question comes up, well, where was the money, right? Did they have the money in trust? Did they have the funds in the first place to self-fund? This scares me because a lot of the opponents of self-funding have in the past argued that self-funding only works until there's a large claim, and then most employers don't have the financial wherewithal to cover the claim, and it's going to end up with a bankrupt employer and an employee whose medical bills are not being paid. So that scares me a little there. And are the payment limitations enforceable? And again, we were just talking about some examples of how you phrase your exclusions and causation and things like that. The last slide, and this is an example of, we already mentioned, when they're asking, where was the money? Did you have the money in trust? Did you have adequate assets to cover the cost of the plan? You know, when a claim doesn't get paid, the provider is filing an appeal with the plan, the provider is balance billing the patient, and the provider is filing complaints. The patient who's being balance billed is filing complaints. And when all this noise is occurring, that's when the DOL is going to trigger an audit. So, again, this is a problem that we saw years and years and years ago with balance billing. We knew it then. We know it now. Providers don't balance bill because they actually expect the patient to whip out a checkbook and cut a check for 50 grand. All right? We're not all John Jablon here. We can't all just cut a check, right, you know, and get rid of the balance. You know, they do it because they want to scare the employee into approaching their plan, getting them to pay, approach their employer, get them to change their coverage, but also to complain to the DOL because that's going to light a fire in the provider's opinion and stop what they believe to be an abusive practice. So that tends to be the source of a lot of these DOL audits that we're seeing today, are these complaints not only by the member, but encouraged by the provider, if not filed by the provider in the first place. So with that, I just want to thank everybody for joining us. We are out of time. Anyone who asked a question that was not answered, we have them here. We're going to take a look. We'll try to get back to you ASAP. In the meantime, pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. You can see it right there. Be sure to join us for our next webinar. Be sure to sign up for the podcast, and we look forward to talking to you in August. Thank you, everybody.